wonderful, as always, to see all of your faces and to sit together. So this week, we read Parsha Naso, the second chapter in the book of Bamidbar, in the wilderness. Bamidbar, the wilderness, is full of problems. As soon as one problem passes, another arises. And this week's reading transmits a state of agitation, confusion, fear, blaming, and yet the persistent theme of longing to stay in connection with Yud-Heh Vav-Heh. Last week, Reb Moshe gave us a beautiful introduction to the symbolic meaning of being in the wilderness, Bamidbar, removed from the constraints and comforts of everyday life, away from the routines that keep us grounded or maybe keep us stuck. We can feel liberated, but also bewildered. In his book, The World Could Be Otherwise, Norman Fisher describes meditation as the most direct way to cultivate imagination, to open up a big space in the middle of our lives, a space that's always there, but usually unnoticed, in which anything can happen. So we can think of the Bamidbar as this big open space, this big meditation retreat that the Israelites and every one of us who reads Torah has to enter and emerge from as part of their spiritual journey. It was only 1 week ago that we were celebrating being at the very mountaintop, the symbolic place of revelation and union with Yud-Heh Vav-Heh during Shavuot, in which the mystery and majesty of life is unfolding in each moment, and all of us are interconnected and completely present, opening the channel to the divine. And now, just a week later in Parsha Naso, we find ourselves frightened, confused, grasping for certainty where there is none. So I'm reminded of Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, how the heart grows wise on the spiritual path. He begins the book with this practical insight. We all know that after the honeymoon comes the marriage, after the election comes the hard task of governments. In spiritual life, it's the same. After the ecstasy comes the laundry. If Jack Kornfield were to write a new edition, perhaps he would acknowledge that the current daily tasks that challenge our equanimity. From this point of view, to me, laundry seems to me much friendlier to mindful awareness than applying for health insurance online, renewing your driver's license online and in person, and accessing all your passwords for the next time-sensitive and critical thing you should have done yesterday. So, after revelation, how do we function in day-to-day life in a challenging world? Of course, even without online applications for driver's licenses, our wandering ancestors had even more to dread, even more uncertainty to bear. In Parsha Naso, the pervading question is, how do we maintain that open channel to Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, our only hope and guide in getting through this wilderness, when things are so challenging and scary in our day-to-day life, and so fraught in this camp that's supposed to maintain a portal for Yud-Heh Vav-Heh? How can we maintain this clear and open channel in real life? The beginning of Naso creates a bridge from the preoccupation of the book of Leviticus, which talks all about what the priests need to do to maintain purity, to the concern of how the priestly functions can be maintained in the community. It begins with a description of the jobs for the Gershonite and Merarite clans, the descendants of the Levite tribe. The jobs here are for these clans are the packing and porterage of the sacred temple objects. Reb Moshe once described these plans as the roadies for the tabernacle. Very detailed descriptions are given for the dismantling of the cloths, the hangings, the screens, the altar, the posts and their sockets, and pegs and cords. And once the care and maintenance of all the sacred furnishings are assigned as tasks to specific people, the maintaining of the purity of this portal for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh to dwell among these resides in the maintenance of all these details. And so as the Israelites move the tabernacle from camp to camp, they'll be able to maintain purity in the camp so that this will be a welcoming portal for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, because any impurity seems to threaten their connection with the guide upon whom their survival in the wilderness depends. And as I was sitting this morning, and I thought about this part of the narrative, and in a week I'll be going to a retreat that is going to be set up in a summer camp so that the basketball gym will become a zendo. And it becomes a sacred space simply because specific people have been assigned tasks for the cloths that cover the walls and the basketball hoops and the placement of all the sacred objects, so that by the time we arrive, there will be a sacred space created in this summer camp. And so metaphorically, we understand that life can fill us with preoccupations that make it impossible to keep an open channel of connection. And that even as, but wherever we go, we know the tasks, we know the routines that can reestablish this connection. But then we confront a threat to this purity, and it's from anyone who has an eruption or discharge or is defiled by a corpse, touching a corpse. And Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is quoted as saying, remove male and female alike, put them outside the camp so that they don't defile the camp of those in whose midst I dwell. This, of course, seems harsh, and like so many harsh and cruel policies, it's motivated by fear of losing connection with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, the source of life. There are other threats to purity that make more sense, including wrongdoing and the need to make restitution. So we might wonder why the children of Israel are so afraid. After all, were they not brought out of Egypt with the mighty hand of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh? Are they not provided with manna for all their nutritional needs? Is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh not guiding them by a cloud during the day and a fire at night? Yet, for all the reassurances that counter their fears and complaints, the story will go on to reveal that everyone who started on this journey, everyone who trusted Moses as transmitting the word of God, everyone, even Moses and Aaron, everyone except Joshua and Caleb, who left Egypt, will indeed die in the wilderness before reaching the promised land. So when the Israelites cry, did you take us away from the flesh pots of Egypt just to have us die in the wilderness? Ultimately, the answer is yes. The people who left will die, but their children will enter the promised land. So they are indeed making the ultimate sacrifice to deliver their children, literally, to the promised land. And somehow, as many times as I've read this story, I did not really understand this in this way until I attended Torah study last week. So if we go back to Parsha Naso and all the threats of purity to the camp and the clear channel for Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh to dwell among us, the next ordeal we come to is the infamous ordeal of Sotah, the ritual for determining the guilt of a wife whose husband suspects her of having gone astray and been unfaithful. If there are no witnesses, but a fit of jealousy comes over one and he is wrought up about his wife, although she has not defiled herself, the man shall bring the wife to the priest along with a grain offering of jealousy. Aviva Zornberg points out in her commentary on Bamidbar called Bewilderment that in this case, divine aid is sought in contrast to the general principle that issues in the camp are to be decided by due process, by witnesses and majority rulings. It's an exceptional case in contrast to what we read in Deuteronomy, that it is not in heaven that these things are decided. But in this ordeal, the woman has to drink sacral water, into which dirt from the floor of the tabernacle has been mixed, and she'll hold the grain offering while the priest incants magical words that if she's guilty of adultery, the water of bitterness will induce a spell, causing her thigh to sag and her belly to descend. And the priest puts the words of the curse, he writes them down and rubs the words off into the water of bitterness, and she has to drink this water. If she's innocent, she'll be unharmed and able to retain seed. One might say that this is a less lethal ordeal than those of other cultures, including the Salem witch trials, in which drowning, scalding water, and other more lethal means were used to determine guilt or innocence. However, it's humiliating, whatever the outcome, and it seems to be in the service of reassuring a jealous husband. So we see this elaborate ritual invoking the judgment of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh simply to remove the burden of doubt and uncertainty from the jealous husband. It appears designed not simply to prove innocence, but specifically to replace doubt with certainty. It highlights the toxic impact on human relationships when someone is not able to tolerate the uncertainty and ambiguity that are part of everyday life. And the ritual comes off as superstitious, ridiculous, and totally demeaning to the woman. It answers the quest of an agitated mind that's trying to wrest certainty out of doubt. And there's no acknowledgement that relationships with great power differentials and rules that don't take human nature into account, that these situations will lead to secrecy, subterfuge, and doubt inevitably. But rather than addressing these problems in a more mature way, the solution for certainty is sought through this ordeal. But immediately following this, we learn how one may take on a Nazarite's vow to set himself or herself apart from the Lord. The Nazarite abstains from wine and any other intoxicants and draws wider and wider circles, not even eating grapes or anything in which grapes have been steeped. They don't cut their hair, go near a dead person. And the term of service of the Nazarite is ended with a ritual sacrifice. And it's not clear who would take such a vow or why. And there's a debate in the commentaries about whether this path of abstinence is a model of virtue for overcoming our impulses, or whether it's in fact sinful, because one is abstaining from the gifts of life that we are intended to enjoy. The placement of these vows right after the ordeal for the suspected adulteress may suggest that it's a path of repentance. However, Rabbi Eliezer HaKapur, the second century, notes that the ritual ends with a sin offering because the Nazarite must seek forgiveness from God for deliberately abstaining from the potential joys that God prepares for all human beings. Interestingly, the Buddha also came to a similar conclusion, that abstinence itself is not a path to enlightenment. The Buddha tried it and found out that it did not provide the same path to compassion and enlightenment that could be found through the Eightfold Path of understanding, meditation, and ethical action. So the feeling tone in this narrative of the Nazarite's extreme abstinence is also one of agitation, of desperate seeking for certainty in an uncertain and confusing world, and drawing ever-widening circles of protection around one's effort to maintain purity. The Torah has been given, but we are still lost in the wilderness, confused, afraid, and frantically grasping for any means of certainty. And immediately after this ritual for the Nazarite's release from vows comes the priestly blessing. The Lord spoke to Moses, "Speak to Aaron and his sons. Thus shall you bless the people of Israel. Say to them, may Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh bless you and protect you. May Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh deal kindly and graciously with you. May Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh bestow favor upon you and grant you peace." We're suddenly reminded that the reason for all these frantic efforts is to maintain that open, clear channel so we can receive the blessing of life directly from the source. And finally, the parsha ends as Moses finishes setting up the tabernacle. And each of the 12 chieftains brings elaborate gifts described over many pages, making this the longest parsha in our Torah cycle. And the parsha finally ends with a sense of calm and clear connection to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. When Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he would hear the voice addressing him from above the cover that was on top of the Ark of the Pact between the two cherubim. Thus Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moses. Finally, we're reassured that the connection with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh remains accessible, even in the bewildering experience of Bamidbar. I appreciate your taking this confusing and fragmented journey through Parsha Naso with me, as I have no doubt subjected you to the frantic, frightened energy that pervades this narrative. And in this experience, I hope we can find wisdom for dealing with the journey we are on today, when, with the almost daily or weekly news of mass gun violence, the inability of warring factions to agree on ways to address the problems that abound, the discouraging recurrence of wave after wave of COVID, and just last night, the horrifying accounts, videos, testimonies from the January 6th storming of the Capitol. Like the Israelites, we may find ourselves frantically grasping for certainty in a bewildering world, yet the recurring message of Torah and of our practice is that there is always a possibility of clear connection with the mysterious unfolding of life in each moment. We can return to being present with whatever is arising in this moment in our portable sanctuaries, whether that's our bodies or whatever space we create for connection. We can turn away from the frantic search for certainty in a bewildering world and return again and again to the experience of each moment arising. As Norman Fisher reminds us in his book, The World Could Be Otherwise, even if the next moment brings catastrophe, meeting that catastrophe with joyful effort is always possible. When you meet a moment in that way, with the joyful effort we cultivate in our practice, even if it is the last moment of your life, it will be noble, decisive, and lovely. So let's just take a moment of silence before we talk.